Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we have a special guest here tonight that we're bringing back on, okay? And we've got, I want to touch base real quick on last night's podcast that we did. Got a lot of emails concerning that. We'll do a follow-up show in the future on that, of course. I want to thank everybody that tuned in last night. Basically, we had so many different viewpoints where, you know, we were talking about something very difficult and very personal for a lot of people. So it's, you know, tempers sometimes flare, and I appreciate the callers all being respectful. There was a few, obviously, out of line. They were attacking some of the women on the show. That's just totally uncalled for, so I apologize for that. But the for the others that were on the podcast, I want to thank you guys for doing a really great, respectful job and bringing a lot of important information out there, a subject that needs to be talked about. And in a way, this show kind of correlates with that, because we're going to be talking about the prison system and the warehousing of men and women across America. I'm going to be bringing on Marty Bean, okay? And Marty Bean will come on and tell his story, Big Pharma, how he got wrapped up with Big Pharma, and actually did a stint in prison, federal prison, and now has chosen a path of helping the recidivism rate, antirecidivismrate.com. It's a hard word to pronounce. I can't pronounce that for some reason. I was saying it over and over before the show, but very difficult. But Marty will be able to explain it a little bit better. But he's going to tell a story here tonight that's very powerful. It's a personal story. It's a true story. And basically, I think a lot of this information that he's going to give is very, very important, because, look, the prison system, the prison industrial complex here in America, the private prisons, it's the men and women, the warehousing itself is self-explanatory, what I just said right there, warehousing men and women. And a lot of these men and women, when they're released from prison, they have nothing, no way, no programs, no coaching, nothing at all. And those programs, and a lot of them are being preyed upon by the churches out there and other groups out there to take advantage of these men and women, and, you know, and it's just a very corrupt system. But Marty here, I believe he's very honest and very upfront, because he's been inside, he's been behind the wall, so he knows exactly what it takes to, you know, pick yourself up and clean yourself up and go out there and do what is right and, you know, make a life for yourself, reintegrate into society, and become a productive member of society. And Marty here, he's going to become, I'm going to connect him right now. I see his number up there. And Marty, hey, welcome to the podcast here tonight.
Great to be back with you, Joe. So I'm looking forward to a great show tonight. My compliments on the word recidivism.
You're doing much recidivism. Better. I don't know. I'm having a tongue twister tonight.
You know, maybe we should really begin by explaining the definition of the word recidivism. And it
there
is a very difficult word. And when I'm kidding around with someone who is not familiar with the term, the first step is, of course, to pronounce it. And then the second step is to spell it. And it leaves for a lot of comments. But anyway, because it's a very difficult word, recidivism is defined as an individual who goes into prison or jail for a crime that they did commit. And they come out of prison or jail and then commit another crime. For then they are replaced back into the system, in the jail or prison, and that is called recidivism. The recidivism rate currently is anywhere from 60 to 70 to 80% of the incarcerated population that comes out of the prison or jail and returns, because there are no real support services. I mean, there are support services, but none to really make a difference. And that's where my program, anti-recidivism.com, stems from. That's our basis for our platform.
Okay. All right. Well, you said it a lot better than I could. Where do you want to begin here tonight? Why don't you take us from the beginning of what happened? You were involved with Big Pharma. Start there.
Sure.
And explain to us how you got tied up in this network here.
I get this question quite a bit, and the answer is actually not simple. But here's what happened. It's 2011, the year, and I had a partner by the name of Linda Allen, a beautiful woman from Winnipeg, Canada, and we had been in business with the name Global RX Store, and I was guilty by the law, and I'm certainly embarrassed and ashamed of breaking the law. And up to that point, I hadn't really even had a parking ticket. So we decided, to go into business, and we were hearing about the shortage of supply, if you will, for oncologists, those doctors that practice oncology, which is the cancer-fighting medication and direction in the body. And so we thought, let's see if we can't set up a global network of licensed wholesale pharmaceutical firms to buy the product in their particular country and then collectively have it sent to our hub outside of London, who would then send the product in the Royal Mail into the United States. It would convert over to our postal service and down to the final destination, which was our wholesale firm for the United States, was in San Diego, California. From there, the office would open the boxes and dispense individual orders per the doctor's office orders. So that's basically how it worked. We did that for about 5 years. Once in a while, a shipment from London to New York was the entry, the port of entry for customs. They would put the order aside, send it to their lab to do their homework on it, the research to make sure that it wasn't counterfeit. And once it was proven to be the true product, they would simply return it back into the mail system, and the products would then travel down to San Diego. And they were not refrigerated items. So a day or two or 3 days really wouldn't make any difference as far as the quality of the drug, the prescription drugs. These are the same drugs that FDA approves, and they were produced by the same manufacturers around the world. The difference being our price was about 200 to 300% less.
Okay.
So you can see that that could cause a problem maybe down the line. And sure enough, after working this business model day in, day out, 7 days a week, after 5 years, there was at sunrise, I was living in Boca Raton, Florida. And I heard all this commotion at sunrise, and I jumped out of bed, ran down the hall, and what I saw is something that I'll never forget. There were about 25 to 30 individuals in SWAT team uniforms, banging on the glass, on the doors, guns loaded, guns aimed right at my head, because it was a picture window, front picture window. You could see all this. I immediately opened the door. They rushed in, and it was like a scene out of the movie, out of a movie. I mean, and they thought they actually had Scarface, Al Pacino in Scarface, cornered, when in fact they had Marty Bean in his pajamas. And so they were looking for guns in the walls and money in the floors and money in the walls, and there was none of that.
Okay.
And so they went away. And when before the last two individuals, one from the FBA, one from Customs, they sat down, they asked for an interview, and I gave them the interview. I had nothing to hide. We thought the business was legal because everybody was licensed around the world. But it's not. There is a law, a very quiet law, in the Food, Drug, Cosmetic Act that prevents anyone from doing this. So you're actually breaking a federal law, even though you're licensed and you're involved in prescription drugs and so forth and so on. It's illegal unless you have the blessing of the FDA. And at that time frame, not to make an excuse, but at that time frame, the FDA was running very skeletal. In fact, they only had a chairman or a secretary, depending on what the proper term is, who leads the FDA. About one-third of the time during the entire Bush administration of 8 years. And it was then where Proposition B, which is still on the books today, was passed in the middle of the night and so forth and so on. So it was a turbulent time for FDA and drugs and prescription drugs and the cost and the programs and Big Pharma tackling the Hill in the Beltway,
okay.
Capitol Hill. And so when I found out that it was illegal, I shut the business down right away that day. And it was quite an ordeal, as you can imagine, because you had a lifestyle, you had a business, and you're used to doing that 5 days a week, so 5 to 7 days even sometimes in the week. And a lot of people had gained our trust, and they realized that what we said was true and so forth. And now all of that had to come to a screeching halt. So we did that, and it was unfortunate. And so, all right, what am I going to do now? You know, Linda and I were saying, what are we going to do? Linda, by this point, became the love of my life and vice versa. And we decided we were going to get married, which would be our second marriage for each of us, in the first quarter of 2012. In November 2011, so it's only a few months after the SWAT team and the close of the business. Linda called routinely, and it was a Saturday afternoon, and she was feeling pretty good. She was going over for a dinner party with our best friends that we had done this dozens and dozens of times. And so it would be a nice break for her to sit down and have a nice dinner and then a good couple of hours out. And she said, you know, when I get back, I'll give you a call, honey. All right. And that was that. This was in mid-afternoon, as I mentioned to you. About 11 o'clock that night, the phone rings, and I thought it was Linda. However, it was Linda's daughter-in-law, Pam, who's married to her one son, Brian, and they had two kids. And she said, Marty, I have some bad news. Linda took a spell at dinner, had a stroke, and is on life support. Well, at first I thought it was a joke, you know, but it wasn't. It was true. So within a period of, all right, what do we do? And then you call the doctors and you open up the telephone lines directly to the hospital and the nurse's desk and so forth and so on. And you get daily reports. And Linda was on life support because she had relatives on the west coast of Canada, where Winnipeg is in the central portion. And so to give them time to prep and make the travel, the journey to the funeral. I can tell you it's a difficult time, and you're still in the house in Florida by yourself, and we're all the buzz and electricity and all the fun and all the photographs, because I was an amateur photographer that we had taken, you know, with our travels around the world. And now she's gone. So just when you think you can't get any, things can't get any worse, 2012 is ushered in, and it was extremely difficult. It really was. I was able to get some help with hospice care as far as grieving, and help me with that.
And how long ago was this now? She passed away, Linda? How long ago was it? How many years?
Well, she passed away actually in November 2000 and December actually 2011. So yeah, it's hard to believe that it's already almost nine years.
How is that? How is that real quick? How is that? I mean, how are you coping? I mean, have you met someone else? Are you remarried? Or how is that?
It hasn't been the same. It's been difficult. I have written a book, a memoir called. It's entitled All My Tomorrows, and it covers my life growing up outside of Philadelphia and then transitioning to California after schooling and so forth and so on. And then it talks a great deal about, of course, Linda and our business and then going to prison. And so the book is dedicated to her memory, and it's at the editorial stage as we speak. So we're working on that to get that out on the shelves.
I'm getting some inquiries about, well, what about your family? How did they take this, you know, and stuff? I mean, you know, get a little more in depth about how your family took you going to prison.
When the business closed, the family and the friends. That landscape changed.
Okay.
A lot of people went away. My family, I have a brother who lives in the suburbs of Philadelphia. I did travel up to Philadelphia for that Christmas in 2011, and we had a mass said and so forth and so on. I was not able to travel to Winnipeg for the service, which even hurt me even more, being the son of a conservative funeral director. So I grew up in the business. And so not being able to go through, you know, the formalities it just added more to the problem. And so I'm alone at the house. There's the business is clearly dried up. There's no income. And September 2012, there's another knock on the door at sunrise. And they said, it's the same FDA gentleman who said, Marty, I'm sorry, but I'm here to arrest you. So it was, you know, quite a bit of time had gone by on the calendar, and yet I was being arrested. So you're rushed off to the magistrate, the hearing, which was held in West Palm Beach, jail facilities, the legal courtroom there. And my maximum penalty, as the magistrate was reading the charges, amounted to this. 35 federal counts that carried the maximum penalty of 131 years.
Wow.
Now, I mean, you become numb just, you know, standing there, moving, standing at the podium, saying, okay, what's, you know, and now you're going to find out that you're being arraigned on 35 counts, federal charges, and a maximum penalty of 131 years. That was devastating. I mean, you literally become numb. And so there was no bail because I was being held without bail for the transition to San Diego, California, because that's where the money actually changed hands with our wholesaler in the United States. So you may have seen the movie. They did a movie about Con Air, and it was about the airplane system that the federal government has for inmates to move them around. And you, in the movie, which I think starred Spacek, they show individuals with like leather mask on so they can't spit, and very dramatic individuals are on that airplane.
Yeah.
And now it included me. I'll never forget standing on the tarmac and the sharpshooters go around the plane. I think they did this in the movie. I don't know what they're looking going to shoot out of the sky. But anyway, they are placed around the plane, and then you go up the temporary steps, you know, the rollaway steps, into the plane, and then they have your seat already allocated, and off you go. You have no idea where you're going. You know the destination, but you don't know how you're going to really get there. And there's all kinds of stories. It could take a month. It could take a week. It could take a couple of days. And in my case, it only took a couple of days. So then from there, you're transported down to San Diego where you're going to actually be held. So that is in a federal prison located at the Tijuana-San Diego border, which was managed by CCA, now known as CoreCivic. So it was a privatization facility, which was split in half with immigration issues people and what they call the marshals. You're under the marshal thumb, really, when you're in that stage of prison. So from there, the first thing you do, you go in front of the magistrate. Do that exercise all over again. And now they say to me, Mr. Bean, your bail is set. $2 million. I thought that was a little steep.
Yeah.
And so, but that was the bail amount. And in lieu of bail, I spent 6 months in that prison on a medium level floor. And you're in there with more than the Boy Scouts at that level. And so I was there for 6 months, and I was there when I realized that not everybody in prison is a criminal. I mean, thank God for prisons. We do need prisons. We do. They need to be managed differently, but we do. But it was there that I was able to not just help people, but listen to what their problems were. And this gained a great deal of notoriety. To the point, like, maybe several times a week, if it wasn't one of the correction officers, it was another inmate, you don't use the word inmate, I'm sorry, any longer, it's incarcerated adult, would come up to me, and you address everybody by their last name. And so they would say to me, hey, Bean, what are you doing here? Why are you here? So, when I signed my plea agreement at the end of 6 months, I was then released automatically. Forget the $2 million bail. It was a signature bond that my sister was kind enough to step up. It was my sister and a friend from high school. Only two people still standing. Everything else, Joseph, went away. My watch. I knew the car was going away because I had to back it out of the garage. Because the one marshal, the day I was arrested, didn't know how to really drive an automatic Jaguar. But anyway, so I rolled that back for the tow truck. And everything, all the content, all the physical product that you had in your life went away. It's gone.
Wow. Well, that happens to probably a lot of inmates in the prison system. Their property is stolen, ends up transferred someplace else, you know?
It's a mixed story. Not necessarily so. I mean, especially if it's a family, there's nothing taken unless, you know, there's contraband or something like that. But there certainly was never any contraband. Anyway, so it all went away. And here you are. Here I am. In a cell with two bunks. And nobody.
Yeah.
And still, the individuals thought I was hiding, you know, millions of dollars that I had tucked away, which I'm penniless at this point. So, fast story, went to the halfway house, and I had this idea. I wanted to help the inmates because I had a very good life, and now I wanted to do something different. And that may sound a little corny or vanilla, but it was a fact. It's a true fact. Still is. And I had the ability to make a difference. And so I did. And I am. And so I put together the business plan and started to roll the program out. And now comes time to be actually sentenced. And, you know, I still didn't really get the idea I was going to go to prison. It just didn't fit. And there's not enough time to supplement that, but it still didn't fit. So we went to the hearing, the sentencing, and the judge had to get the soundbite, Bean goes to prison. Remember, Big Pharma is watching all of this. And so they did. But they sent me to what they call a camp level, which is a very casual, comfortable level, and thank God they did. And you know, you meet, that's where you have the real white collar, the political individuals and the lawyers and the accountants and dentists and doctors and so forth. And so that was the community there, completely unlike the prison at the border, which were more drug oriented and a few other crimes. And so when I was released, I had an early release, and then I mentioned, and I was then put on probation. And as part of the penalty, you have what they call restitution. That's where the court fines you dollars and cents for your crime. My restitution, and at the camp, I was involved with people who had restitution dollar amounts excessive of $70 million, $80 million. So my dollar figure is much smaller, but it's an interesting quick story. In the course of our clients for Global RX Store, when we had the network, there was a particular doctor in Boca Raton, Florida. He had relocated from New York, and his mother was left alone in New York, and you know, all the relatives were asking him to have mom come down to Boca Raton, Florida, and you know, take care of Ma. Ma is very strong-willed and so forth, and you know, my son, the doctor, as the jokes go, I guess, was single. And so he was, you know, one of the on the list of the doctors. So the authorities knock on the door, hello, we're from here and there, and you know, yes, okay, here, contact the lawyer. We don't want to talk to you, which is, you know, the correct thing to do, right? And all the
I've got a couple callers here, real quick. Can you give it like a quick 15-second summary of real quick about your story? Just I got some callers saying they missed the beginning and they're like a little bit lost here. If you want me to do it, I could do it, but I think you're better summarizing
well,
your story
sure,
than I am.
Yeah, I'm not sure where they they came in or what their specific question. Maybe you could patch them through and
yeah.
We could answer
what's
that
what,
way?
What are you trying to get at here? Well, they're emailing me, messaging me. What parts did you miss here? The beginning here. I mean, I don't understand. They want a summary of what the beginning. We can't recap the whole show. I guess. He was, I don't know where he wants me to begin. I mean, maybe he'd call in and ask, press the number, call in, and press the number one, and I'll pass you through, and you can ask,
pass
you a question. Yeah, because I just don't know where we can do it. You know, I guess he missed the beginning. I don't know. All right, but go ahead. I'm sorry. Continue on. If I see him calling through on the phone line, I'll patch him through.
Sure. And so we'll wrap up the restitution quick story. So the doctor said, call my attorney. The legal people called the attorney, and the attorney is a real gruff guy, and he said, okay, what can I do for you? And they said, you did this, and he said, that's correct. However, yes, we did do business with Marty Bean. And yes, we did buy prescription drugs, but when we received them, we just didn't feel like we wanted to dispense them. Okay. And the doctor's order for the first time was a little excessive. Normally it's $5,000 or $6,000, and just to see how everything goes and so forth. Being a conservative and cautious, obviously.
Here's my caller now. Here's my caller. Hang on, here's the caller right now. Go ahead, Connecticut, state of Connecticut. Go ahead. You're live.
Yeah. It sounds like a very interesting story you're talking about, but I did miss the beginning. What brought this all on? What were you selling? Prescription drugs, or starting a business selling drugs, or what actually?
Okay, good question. That's a good question.
I came on when the FBI showed up at your door.
Okay, it was the FDA, by the way. The FBI was never there, so even though there was some letterhead, public relations press releases on their letterhead, the FBI never showed up. They just never showed up. I never met anyone, even through the entire case, who was from the FBI. Anyway, the reason that we started a business, and by the name of Global RX Store, whose purpose was to distribute wholesale pharmaceutical products in an oncology's product line for the doctors to dispense in their office, the chemo drugs. And I was guilty, and I regret it immensely every day, but I was the original architect to set up a global network of licensed wholesale pharmaceutical firms around the world who would collect and get the best price in their country for a particular drug that we needed, okay? And it's the same drug manufacturers doing the same products, only each country pays a different price point for the product. And we would collect the merchandise and through London, where it was our hub in Europe, and they would collect the orders, wrap them up, package them up, put them in the Royal Mail system, and then it would transfer when it got to the United States into the United States Postal Service, and then delivered to our wholesale location in San Diego for the actual doctor orders for distribution. So that's how that started. So I'm glad we had a chance to bring you up to speed
a little
bit.
Did that answer your question there?
Yeah, that's good to know what happened there. And it seems strange that you weren't manufacturing them at all. You were just reselling them, and all this happened. But that's good to
correct.
Know. And now I know where you're coming from. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you for calling. So on the restitution, to wrap the restitution story up, okay, the authorities are interviewing the lawyer for this good doctor in Boca Raton, Florida, and the dialogue went something like this. Okay. Did you do business with Martin Bean? Yes, we did. Okay. And, how many times? We only had the one order. And when we received that order, we didn't feel real good about it. And we decided not to dispense it. Okay. And what did you do with the $18,000 price tag on your order? What did you do with the content? We have no record of that, although we believe that we poured the content down the drain. Down the drain? That's correct. And they said, let me get this straight. You order prescription drugs, you receive the drugs, you open them up, you say, you know, I don't know. We're not going to do this. And instead, you just open them up and pour them down the drain? That's correct. How'd you pay for the drugs? Visa. Did you call Visa to stop payment or question any processing of funds? We have no record of that. What happened, just to recap, once again, you received the order in a retail, your cost, the wholesale cost was about $18,000, yes, and you decided not to dispense the meds, and instead you poured them down the drain. That's correct. Thank you very much. We appreciate your time, and thank you for helping us out here. Now, that sounds a little difficult to believe. But the judge said, okay, after hearing this testimony via long-distance telephone, which was broadcast in the courtroom, that Mr. Bean, you owe the good doctor $18,000. And that was my restitution. Joseph?
Yes. Yep. I'm listening. Go ahead. I'm letting you carry it on right there. I'll just go on to the next page if you wanted the story.
Yeah. That was my restitution. So I'm out of prison. I am in a halfway house. All of that is behind me, and now I'm even more determined to put a program together as a support mechanism for incarcerated adults, men and women, not just men and women. When you're liked and you have friends and so forth, when you're in prison, the night before you're released, your friends or your friends that are in prison usually will have a dinner for you, and they had a dinner for me. And you'd be surprised how creative some of these guys can be with microwave ovens. But anyway, and it's just nice. It's a nice way of saying, hey, good luck, and, you know, all the niceties and all that. And so we had the dinner, and I'll never forget, the dinner's closing up, and you know, we're starting to say goodbye, and the one individual said to me, looked me straight in the eye, and he said, Bean, let me tell you something, because they were very much aware of what I wanted to do. He said, Bean, you have no right to fail. Don't let us down. And that kind of stuck with me, you know. So when I get a little discouraged or whatever, that, you know, maybe it's not going to work and all that, I think back to that statement. And so anti-recidivism.com becomes the name of the business, as well as our URL, so you can, that is the website address as well. And it's also the number one name in any country's DOJ vernacular. Anti-recidivism.com. Every country in the world, because of consumer pressure, is trying to reduce the number of individuals incarcerated. And this was before COVID. Now, with COVID, that it adds a whole different slant to the prison community, if you will. But that's how the business started. We are a virtual coach for someone who was arrested, especially those for the first time, and realize that they don't know only what they saw on TV when it comes to prison. They've never even heard of the term pretrial, which is the first stage of the journey. There's pretrial, then sentencing and incarceration, and then there's the reentry, probation, and parole. They are the terms that all fall under this recidivism, or better yet, anti recidivism. So, I mean, you think about it. How many winners do you know in your life that are successful in any realm, with sports, music, academics, it doesn't matter, who did not have a coach? I don't know anyone. I know a great deal of, quote, successful people, but I don't know any who didn't have a coach. So now, when you're arrested and you have all the fear, all the anxiety, all those emotions that are just racing through you and your loved ones, we can make contact with you, or you make contact with us, I should say, and we can reduce all those fears and let you know, okay, here's what's going on, here's the next step, and here's what is expected. And then the same holds true for when you are, quote, incarcerated, where there you go into a whole new world. You have three sets of laws. You have the, if it's a state law, Department of Corrections, you have their guidelines and their laws. Beyond that, you have the warden and the actual facility and their laws. And then you have, beyond that, the inmate shot caller rules of compliance. So it can be a great deal to learn and adjust. And if you have a coach to help you do that, I think it makes all the sense in the world. When you are ready to reenter it back into the community, That's another tremendous transition, especially if you've been there for more than a couple of years, because of how the world's changing, electronics and it's cell phones and so forth and so on. The world is not the same as it was 5-10 years ago. Well, you missed all that, so now you have to catch up with that pretty quick. We can also prep you and help you also with your resume, job interviews, so that when you come out, you hit the ground running. We have one of our corporate sponsors, which is the friendly folks there at AT&T. And we will be able to, we are able to supply an iPhone upon reentry. Now, that may not sound like much, but trust me, an individual who has, no direction and no, not even a phone, how are they supposed to navigate today's world? To begin with that, if they don't have some type of a coach, you can't, which is why the recidivism rate is what it is today.
And what are those numbers? Can you give those numbers again, please?
My telephone number?
The American, through the prison systems in America and whatnot. What is the, for instance, has it gotten worse? And can you give me, the progression rate of how it, or has it, because they said the prison numbers were actually down.
Excuse me. Certainly. There's about 7,500 facilities in the United States. That would include the federal, which is only 100 and some units of facilities, the state, each state, and then the jails. The jails being the larger numbers, of course. The recidivism rate, where the individual return to prison or jail, is somewhere north of 60%, sometimes 70%. And that's just the shame. Our platform is based completely on education. There's no difference as far as the individual beside the obvious, who's outside the prison wall or inside the prison wall, as far as their brain.
Okay.
Those
who
are on the outside.
I just hang on. I want to call her 657-383-0616. Marty Bean, he's on the show here telling a story how he was in prison. He's what's the name of the website again people can go to?
It's www.anti-recidivism.com.
Okay. All right. And now, can we dip a little bit further into this? Now, you basically handle, you like to start off with the pretrial detainees. And why is that?
Absolutely. Because the sooner that an individual can get their bearings, if you will, and get in alignment with their next couple of years, the better. Okay, so especially when it comes to education. Okay, but the earlier point that I was trying to make is the intelligence. There's a great deal of intelligence and creativity on the other side of the wall in prison. But those individuals didn't have the nurturing upbringing, mom reading to them at night, that a lot of us had, which is now labeled as privileged, on the outside of the wall. And those of us who grew up on the outside of the wall always were told, college, college, college. You need to go to college. It was drilled into us. Well, the individuals didn't make it or didn't hear that, and they made other choices, and a lot of them are on the inside of the wall. My point is, you offer education to that same population, and watch what the difference is. And look at, and that will also drive down the rate of recidivism.
Uh-huh.
If the individuals are who are not incarcerated, who do not have that education, are in just as almost in deep trouble as the ones who are behind the wall without the education. So it's education, education, education.
Yeah, education is the key to success, and that's through your experience. Now, did that hold out true? Was it now when you were inside the federal prison? What can you describe? What programs do they offer the inmates there that are inside the prison?
They had several programs. They were just beginning with the college at that time, because computers, of course, were like an endangered species. The prison system really fought that tooth and nail. But finally, they were allowed to have the computers in one building under strict supervision, and you could do your what you know now is known as e-learning, and get your degree. And some had gone all the way through to the master's. You know, you always have one that's the master's. I don't know that we had any PhDs at the camp, but they also had the blue collar training, if you will, the welding and the plumbing. And if you were a master plumber, for example, and you're in prison at a camp, you're going to be a person of real privilege because you're going to work for practically nothing, and you provide a tremendous, you know, service that's needed almost every day. So, and the welding, there was training, that type of training. So, yes, there was training. You know, they really need to pick it back up, make it stronger.
Okay.
In
does
the federal side,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. On the federal side with education, you must have your, if you do not have your high school diploma, you are required to get what they call a GED. And so you have to have that, and or you won't. That's mandatory on the federal side. I don't know what the status is on the state side.
And what kind of partners are you intertwined with as far as the I guess you could say, are you working side by side with anybody, or is it just you? Or I mean, well, how many? I mean, or you know, how does
it
work?
We have strategic partners, and we're expanding different avenues in that area. On a regular basis, we have two major programs that are a little bit premature to talk about. So I'd rather not do that. But they would all really benefit the inmate. And even though you have great programs for the inmate population, whether it's male or female, that program still must be approved by each DOC, each state, and then, of course, the federal system. Okay? So there's a lot of check marks all along the line to get a new program. The one encouraging thing that's happening right now that I could speak a little bit about is the telephone companies. And I'm sure you know, Joseph, as well as your listeners, that you know, a telephone conversation, you could pay a couple dollars a minute. And so there's been, obviously a great deal of discussion over the last 10 years about that and it being excessive.
Okay.
And so there are changes going on right now with those types of firms that provide that service, and the rates are coming down. So it's about time. So that's really the only good news that I see at the moment as far as the world of corrections.
Okay. All right. Now, as far as the federal prison system, what's the difference between the federal prison system and the state prison system?
That's a good question. You hear that all the time. And I guess the federal system, the generic answer is the food.
Okay.
And the food is a major deal. I mean, it sounds, you know, like it's the food. What, you know? But no, the food in a prison is a major deal, and so the quality of food. And so there's no difference having spent time in the Palm Beach jail system, which was just the worst. I mean, I don't even know how it passes for food. Then you go to the federal system, and it's night and day. It really is. And then you go to a camp, and then it's even more upgraded, if you will. But as far as each state, really it's up to the governor as to whether or not the governor requires the Department of Corrections to either be a warehouse for humans, or they're really going to do a rehabilitation program for humans. So, and that varies, just as the right to vote. There's only,
yeah,
I think, about two or three states that simply outlaw voting if you're a felon and or even if you're incarcerated. And now up there, I believe Maine and maybe two others, even if you're incarcerated, you can vote. But for the most part, you have to complete your incarceration. States, there are certain states that take it to that level. And then there's states that take it a little bit further where you have to also pay your restitution.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be completed with probation or your parole, and then you can vote. So it's opened up quite a bit.
Okay. Well, now when you're in a federal prison system, now they have parole. Both they offer parole, correct? Now, do you,
yes,
help inmates that are on parole?
We do. Parole is actually the label for the state reentry program. So you're going to be in the Department of Corrections in a given state for the term parole. On the federal side, it's probation. And we can get involved. It's a little late in the game, but it's never too late to get involved with education. But you're coming out and you're done, and, you know, there's definitely a need for a coach there. Definitely need a coach,
yeah,
there. Just to connect, what we say, connect the dots. And so that's really what that's predominantly about. When you're incarcerated, it's 110% for education, and then also the relationship with family members. So we want to be careful if we can maintain a real low response, if you will, that needs family law, divorce, child custody, all of those issues that really wear thin on your head, if you will, when you're in the bunk there in a prison cell.
Okay. All right. Well, that's pretty well outlined. Now, you said you don't have any numbers as far as what's your success rate with what your coaching. I mean, obviously you've done some research into this. Can you get into that aspect of why? I mean, research you've conducted,
and
why this works?
Yeah, we get that. You know, what's your response rate and so forth and so on. And to me, it's a difficult question to answer. Okay.
Okay.
So. And I answer it in a fashion, especially if I'm dealing with someone in a Department of Corrections. And I say to him, well, tell me about your response rate. And that discussion is going to stop right there because they're at like 60, 70%.
Okay? Yeah.
And so then I'm going to bring up the point, well, let me give you a scenario. Okay. I said, you get arrested. You realize the value of a virtual coach. You realize you made a mistake. And you want to turn your life around. And you realize you need a coach to do that. Okay. So when the coach, and you align yourselves with our service, which is going to run probably, because we're private pay for the most part, let's say $400 a month. All right. And you do that for 24 months, 36 months. Do you think at the end of that, month in, month out, and how you've progressed as a model prisoner because of that, that when you walk out and walk back into your house or your neighborhood, are you going to rob the liquor store on Saturday night?
No, I would say no. Kind of insane, right?
Well, that's what they say. They start laughing. I said, what are you laughing at? Why are you laughing? That's my response on our program. And besides, if somebody doesn't recidivate in 1 year, does that mean they're never going to recidivate? Or they make it 3 years or 5 years? So is that a guarantee? They just made it, you know, to the finish line? No. It's never over until the cemetery is your last turn on the street. Then you know
you're
not going back to prison.
Okay, all right. Well, a little pause there. Let's see here. I'm going to check the call boards here. Two people did have their hands up. They put them back down because I answered their question for them. Let's see here. I don't know if Connecticut is still up there or not. Move down the line here. Anybody else who wants to chip in, ask Marty a question, or maybe you know somebody that may be able to take advantage of the service that he's trying to offer, or have a question about how let's ask this. How can people contact you again, and what should they consider when contacting you? Like, let's just say I'm arrested yesterday. I'm in the Guilford County Jail, let's just say. My bond is $350,000, pretrial detainee. I'm looking at 5 years in prison. What do I do? What do you recommend?
The first thing you want to do is, of course, you're going to make bail. Then you're going to get an attorney. And then you better call us. And then you better call. And the telephone number to call, area code 619-518-04. And we are publicized through LinkedIn, Facebook, and of course the web. So we're pretty easy to get in touch with. But on the pretrial, you're going to be so overwhelmed and so scared that everything is going to go away, and it might, that you really need someone to be really knowledgeable and really supportive and be in your corner. And what I mean by that is we do not get involved in your case as far as the legalities. That's for the lawyers, whether they are appointed, public defenders, or private practice. That's their world. We do not cross that line. But if you talk to any criminal defense lawyer, he will tell you about the need, and they don't get paid to do that, about a coach and a supportive person, because you're all alone. And the more you try to tell people about your innocence, the more you look like you're lying, and they're convicted. You're convicted. So you really need to have a coach. You really and truly do. And it's very important as to what is coming up next. That's a major issue. And obviously, especially in pretrial, because you're still not incarcerated.
Okay. All right. Well, if you have anything else you want to add, I don't have any callers on my call board here, unfortunately. I've I have several listening, but I don't have any questions. If there's anything else you want to cover, Blog Talk actually did cut my time down about 35 minutes tonight. Why, I don't know. I think it was because I went over it. Oh, that's right, because when did we do our show last time? I think it was at the 7:30 mark, and that was the primetime slot. Yep.
Okay, I
see what's going on. The 8:30 slot is an hour and a half, and then at the 9 o'clock, they give you 2 hours, 9 to 11, and obviously anything after that, they do give you, well, you know, you're running into midnight, you run into the next day. If it goes over midnight, then they cut back your time.
Sure.
I think that's how it goes. But what I wanted to add is, you know, also, though, is are you the only individual that's worked, do you have a staff? Do you have anybody that's, like, counselors, that people that go out, you know, that handle anything for you?
Yeah.
You mentioned
we
Linda
have
earlier.
As far as counselors. They're not really counselors. I mean, they are counselors to what we call lifestyle counselors. They are not clinical counselors. We do have two other individuals, two adults, who are actually have been arrested, and so they can feel, you know, what that individual is talking about. It's not a cerebral book learning type of training. You have to know what that individual is feeling. Otherwise, you can't really communicate. You have to get that sense of fear, and then you have to decrease it, and we do that. We can do that. And so that's the way it works. We have interviews are about 15 minutes because that's about the time frame on the telephones. And if you have a tablet, you're fortunate to have a tablet and you can reach us on it, then that can be increased. But for the communication via the telephone, it's in increments of 15 minutes. And if it's the loved one, the spouse, for example, at home, they can call us. We permit for 30 or 60 minutes even. And that's really the format.
Okay.
All right. Well, that's about all I have.
Now, what I would like to do is I'd like to line you up to come back because you said there's a wide range. There's a lot of things that we talked to. See, what we did is before the show here, we lined up what we wanted to talk about. We kind of covered it pretty quickly. But what I would like to do is line something up where we can schedule something in the future, maybe in a week or 2 weeks, and where we can put together the another portion of what depth of the story we can go into and how. I mean, what do you think? Because it's your organization.
I would enjoy that. I would enjoy that very much. In fact, if you had on your end individuals who are working with a Department of Corrections or working with as a pretrial officer or probation officer, and they wanted to listen and ask, you know, we do a Q&A on the show, that's welcome. So. You know,
that's what I need. Yeah, what I'd like to do is I'd like to reach out. Yeah, well, I have many groups on my my Facebook, for instance, Facebook account, where I have Inmates Lives Matter, stuff like that.
I have
that. I'll go to.
Yeah, I'm with them as well. I'm with them as well.
Oh, okay. See that.
What you might want to do, okay, is contact the administrator of that Lives Matter, Inmates Lives Matter, and there's a few others as well, and see if they would be interested in being on the show. I'm sure they would. But I am on their, that's the pen pal program, you know, where you can write letters to incarcerated people. Yeah, that would be a good show. That would be a good show.
Sounds good. That's what I'll do. And there's several other groups, too, that I have. I have Belly of the Beast. That's another one. I had a female on, actually. It was on my show. She was from California. Her husband was doing a life sentence, and he was up for parole. And he served 25 years, and they denied his parole. He's been there 25 years already, and he's been clean, you know, not in any trouble. And, you know, that's 25 years, not getting any trouble inside the prison system. They put him up for parole, and they denied him. And now he has to wait another 5 years before he can go back. And, he's married. She stayed with him the entire time. A loyal woman, obviously, stay with her husband that long. That's rare today.
True. Right. And it depends on the nature of the crime, you know.
Yeah.
They just don't forget. There was, of course, speaking of California, we had the many famous criminals, if you will, that are incarcerated here. For example, Manson, who passed away. There was, I'll tell you a quick Manson story. Manson had been in several prisons in the state of California. And all top-level as far as security and so forth and so on. Okay. But he had a notoriety that no other incarcerated prisoner ever had. And that was, when you're incarcerated, you have a ID badge, ID card. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Manson, when he was first brought into the system, had his ID card. Well, somehow, some way, the ID card kept being missing. Okay? And, of course, people were selling it, and guards and so forth and so on, and they were selling, you know, Manson's ID card. And so they actually had to give him an ID bracelet.
Okay.
Because of that.
Well,
anyway.
Yeah, well,
a little
special ID bracelet, yeah, yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well,
but
all
yeah,
right.
Let's,
well, Mr. Martin,
let's yeah. try to do that. Let's try and set that up.
Well, yes, I'll be in touch with you, I assure you. I will call you out throughout the course of the week, and this way we can get maybe a panel of people on. We can, the conversation can go a little bit where it's not just one-sided, where you're just telling your story. Because, you know, obviously you tell your whole story. I mean, we can sit here and talk 8 hours, talk about your entire life, you know, but
right.
what we want to
yeah,
do
true.
Is get a panel talk about this. Yep.
But no,
all
I
right.
like the
right,
I do, and I'll look forward to hearing from you on that, Joseph.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Understanding the times in which we live today, Marty Bean. If you go back, it'll be archived in the blogtalkradio.com/Joseph Gibson. And you could download the show, and I'm sure we'll get a lot of downloads we did for the last time. All right, everybody, have a good night. God bless, and look forward to the next podcast.
Good night.